have a curmudgeonly remark to begin the talk with. So every astrophysical radiation background that we know of, and there are many of them, was at some point an unidentified radiation background. And none of them, except the ones we're discussing, are any longer unidentified radiation backgrounds. And none of them have to do with dark matter. Sorry. Anyway, after that curmudgeonly remark, I'll get to the science. So I'm going to talk about some astrophysical constraints to various dark matter particle properties. So in the standard canonical scenario, we assume that dark matter is collisionless. And the reason why we assume dark matter is collisionless in astrophysics is because it's the spherical Kao approximation. It's the easiest thing to assume about this stuff which is not seen. It turns out, though, that that spherical Kao assumption, which was really introduced by astrophysicists and cosmologists to simplify the calculations, it actually turns out that all of the astrophysical evidence that we have, and with increasing astrophysical evidence, it appears that the dark matter is in fact very spherical Kao-ish. So there are a number of observations that one can make to constrain the properties of dark matter particles beyond simply gravitational interactions. For example, non-standard gravitational interactions, interactions amongst themselves, self-scattering of dark matter particles, interaction of dark matter particles with ordinary matter, things like that. Decays of dark matter particles to observable particles or non-observable particles. A lot of these things are constrained. So I'm going to start, though, with some constraints to the scenario that has been discussed in a bunch of recent papers in which there is a boost factor introduced to account for the positron background, and also that have also been introduced to account for some identified gamma ray backgrounds as well. So this is work that I finished with Stefano recently. It's was it October? I think it appeared in October on AstroPH. So it's a relatively short paper, and what we do is we consider constraints to dark matter annihilation cross-sections that are enhanced by a 1 over V factor. So, suppose that the annihilation cross-section times relative velocity can be written as 3 times 10 to the minus 26 centimeters cubed per second times some scaling with velocity, inverse scaling with velocity, and we'll then quantify the magnitude of this by a quantity sigma 26. So sigma 26 is just the constant of proportionality there. So if sigma 26 is 1, then the cross-section is 3 times 10 minus 26 centimeters cubed per second for a velocity close to the speed of light. The reason we write things this way is that if the cross-section for annihilation is larger than 3 times 10 to the minus 26, then dark matter density is too small to account for the relic abundance is too small to account for the observed dark matter density. And if it's smaller than this, then it overflows the universe. Actually, that's not true. I'm going to put a subscript here. So this is the cross-section for annihilation to electron positrons or photons. Now, strictly speaking, as we'll see, this does not necessarily have to be the cross-section for annihilation directly, electron-positron pairs of photons. It could also be the cross-section for annihilation to something else, which then decay to these things. And the reason people have introduced this 1 over V cross-section is that the annihilation cross-section can't get bigger than this, or else you get the wrong relic abundance, but it needs to be bigger than this by about a factor of 1,000 to account for the positron excess that people have seen. So people like to have boost factors that have to be greater than 1,000 if sigma 26 is going to be
not too small compared with sigma 26 is going to be small, smaller than 1. So, the argument that we made in this paper is that, oh yeah, I should say that the V over C in the Milky Way is about 10 to the minus 3, and so this does give you the right answer of sigma 26 is about 10, is about 1. So that gives you the right positron annihilation rate if sigma 26 is about 1 and V over C is about 10 to the minus 3. So the argument that we made in this paper is the following. Today, we have galaxies in the universe, and galaxies...
Mark, do you mean greater than
0.1? Yeah, I think I got that wrong. Actually, let me just get rid of that.
It's not really relevant because the particle can have other annihilation channels. Sigma 26 can't be bigger than that, or else you get sigma. At freeze out, V over C is roughly is of order unity, and so sigma 26. If sigma 26. I'm confusing myself. At freeze out, V over C is of order unity. If this is the only annihilation channel, then this fixes sigma 26 to be equal to 1. If there are other annihilation channels, then sigma 26 has to be less than 1. So sigma 26 has to be less than 1. Okay. It can be much smaller than 1 if there are other annihilation channels. So today, we have a Milky Way that has a velocity dispersion of about 10 to the minus 3. But the Milky Way was formed from the merger of smaller mass halos. So at some earlier time, the mass that's now in the Milky Way was in much smaller halos. And at much earlier times, each of those objects was composed of even smaller things. Etc. And this hierarchy extends all the way back to redshifts of about 1 to 200. So, in standard CDM models, you have a primordial power spectrum. You have density perturbations on all scales. Perturbations on the smallest scales undergo gravitational collapse first, and they form tiny galactic halos that look more or less like the galactic halos that we have now, except that they are much less massive, and the velocity dispersions are much smaller because they're much less massive. The cutoff mass is actually somewhere around 30 solar masses times the kinetic decoupling temperature in units of 10 MeV to the minus 3. So what happens in the early universe...
What do you mean by the cutoff mass?
I'll tell you in a second. So in standard CDM, you have a power spectrum, P of K. It's a function of K. It looks something like that. And it's a power law. And it extends all the way to arbitrarily large K, according to inflation. But in the early universe, you have WIMPs, neutrinos, for example, and they annihilate to standard model particles, U plus U minus, U plus U minus, W plus W minus, etc., and vice versa. But at some point, the temperature drops below the mass of the particles. The abundance of these particles becomes Boltzmann suppressed, and the inverse reaction ceases to occur, as does the forward reaction, and then you get a freeze out. And this gives you the relative abundance. This gives you omega chi h squared about sigma v in units of 10 to the minus 26 to the minus 1.
That's a standard freeze-out calculation. And this occurs when the temperature is roughly 1/20th the mass of the twin. But even after this occurs, you still have a huge number of standard model particles. So even after the temperature drops below 1/20th of the freeze-out of the mass of the particle, you still have elastic scattering of standard model particles like photons and neutrinos. And since there are so many more photons and neutrinos and other light standard model particles than there are WIMPs, these reactions continue to occur until much lower temperatures than this. Okay. So the WIMPs are not finding each other, but there are tons of other particles running around that still scatter from those particles, elastically scatter from those particles, and those elastic scatters keep the temperature of the WIMPs at the same temperature as the ambient gas until much lower temperatures. So this process here I refer to as chemical freeze-out, because this fixes then the chemical potential for the WIMPs. And then this I refer to as kinetic freeze-out, because between the time of chemical freeze-out and kinetic freeze-out, the WIMPs are still in kinetic equilibrium with the primordial plasma. And so it's straightforward to calculate elastic scattering cross-sections for photons with WIMPs, neutrinos with WIMPs, electrons, quarks, etc. with WIMPs. And this was done in a paper that I did with Stefano and Chris Sigurdsson about 2 or 3 years ago. And the bottom line is that the kinetic decoupling temperature in units of 10 MeV is small. It's generally an MeV or a tenth of an MeV, etc. And if you survey the parameter space for supersymmetric or UED, universal extra-dimensional WIMP models, what you find is that this cutoff mass is generally in the range between 10 to the minus 6 to 100 Earth masses. Now, since in the early universe, WIMPs continue to stay in kinetic equilibrium with the primordial plasma, the perturbations in those objects, growth of perturbations on scales smaller than the horizon at this temperature get suppressed. And what happens, therefore, is that all of the power on scales smaller than this cutoff mass gets suppressed. So remember, K goes as 1 over R, and 1 over R goes as mass to the minus 1/3. So in hierarchical structure formation, if there's no cutoff in the power spectrum, you have structure to arbitrarily small scales. But since there's this kinetic decoupling of WIMPs that takes place around an MeV or so, structure on scales smaller than an Earth mass, or whatever the precise number, 10 to the minus 6 to 100 Earth masses is, gets suppressed. So the bottom line is that the first structures, the first gravitationally bound galactic halos that are formed in a CDM universe with WIMP dark matter have masses of order some fraction of an Earth mass, and that takes place at redshifts between 100 and 200. And this is a robust result. Okay, if the power spectrum continues to arbitrarily small scales, which every inflationary model says it does on these scales, then we know with some confidence the first galactic halos had to form at redshift of a few hundred with those masses.
If I had a crazy model where kinetic freeze out and chemical freeze out at the same scale, same temperature, then I would have structure at which direction it goes?
Yeah, then
smaller structure or larger structure?
If you were to have kinetic freeze out at the same time as chemical freeze out, then this would get smaller, and all the constraints I'm going to describe would actually get more severe. To alleviate the constraints I'm going to tell you about, you want to push this to the left. You want to have kinetic freeze out take place later at lower temperature, and what that would imply is you would want to have stronger elastic scattering, or larger elastic scattering cross sections.
In models where you imagine a kind of a secondary stage, so chi goes to phi, and then only later on does the phi decay to equal z minus. In that case, am I still in kinetic equilibrium, or does that kind of multi-stage keep me from being in kinetic equilibrium? Because now there's no.
That's a good question.
I don't
know.
If your phi had, for example, a very long life phi,
yeah,
it might be extremely weakly coupled to,
yeah,
you know, the Steiner model, and I can imagine the outer equilibrium.
Yeah.
The Steiner model. So you could have this dark sector, you know, that, in other words, you're sort of making the freeze out happen entirely in a dark sector in a way, and only later on it dumps energy into the Steiner model.
Right, and you're saying that's going in the direction of increasing whatever bound you're talking about, if I have that.
I'm trying to think through it. So if I had a chi that goes to a phi,
and then the phi lives for a long time before going to the standard model, so that
I don't think that's going to happen. So suppose chi does go to phi,
mm-hmm,
but the cross section for that has to be small compared for the cross section for annihilation to everything else, right? Because I have to have the right relic abundance. So I would have, in your scenario, I'd have chi going to phi.
Mm-hmm.
With a very large cross section, a large cross section at small velocities, but I would have to have chi going to standard model particles, so Q bar, with the regular cross section.
I think I was talking about chi going to phi, that is the thermal, that is the thing that's going to freeze out, but the coupling.
So I mean, you're not trying to explain Pamela, you're not trying to have a large.
Regardless of whether I'm trying to have a large cross section.
Do you want a model where chi just goes to phi, it doesn't annihilate directly to standard model particles at all?
Well, that which happens.
Yeah. I mean, the cutoff scale would depend on however these pi particles scatter off the thermal background.
Right.
You just move the problem to whatever metastable particle you have.
Move the particle.
Wait, you want
pi to be metastable?
That's what I understood. You
yeah.
Pi to be metastable.
Yeah.
And long
loop. Well, I'm just wondering with kinetic freeze out, if I don't actually have, if the dominant annihilation in the early universe is not directly the standard model, but goes through a couple of steps, then I'm wondering, is that going, it sounds like you're saying that's going in the wrong direction.
So suppose we have phi, suppose chi just goes to phi.
Yeah. And
phi is not metastable, but stable.
Well, exactly stable, then you wouldn't be able to stay in thermal equilibrium.
Exactly. So if it's exactly stable,
let's say there's a coupling of 10 to the minus 2.
Enough to keep in thermal equilibrium.
Enough to keep in thermal equilibrium.
With everything else.
The phis are in thermal equilibrium.
With everything else.
With everything else, yeah.
Then you get the same relic abundance.
You're saying it's the same relic abundance, and then the kinetic freeze out, you're saying that's exactly the same, too.
And the phis are going to scatter off through the same process.
So it's just two steps. It's the standard model is keeping in kinetic equilibrium with the phis, which is keeping in kinetic equilibrium with the phis. Okay.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, so it's the same.
That's thing. True for the chemical part, and I guess the kinetic part would be the same. I have to think through that.
What's the mass of the phis
particles?
I don't believe in the phi particles. The phi particles that people have introduced have masses that are few MeV.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, at chemical
freeze-out,
they're relativistic?
Yeah, at chemical freeze-out, they would be relativistic, and I'm...
So, the number density is not
such. The kinetic freeze-out, actually, you would not be able to alleviate the problem with the kinetic freeze-out, because if these things become non-relativistic, then MeV, then the Wnts would kinetically decouple at an MeV. Right.
Make the phi 10 in general.
10 Jeff?
Yeah.
Then it's even worse.
And it's worse because I'm not keeping myself in kinetic.
You're saying the Wnt talks only to the phis,
yeah,
and the phis talk to everything else.
Yeah.
So if the phis disappear at 10 GeV,
mm-hmm,
then the Wnt cease to talk to everything else at 10 GeV, and then this cutoff goes to higher K, higher redshift collapse. Yeah?
I just want to see if I understand this right. So kinetic freeze-out is the point at which you're saying the Wnts would no longer be scattering off photons and neutrinos?
Right.
So is that analogous to the decoupling of photons and baryons at Z of 1,000?
Yep.
So is there a WMAP difference?
That's a good question. The answer is no.
Oh.
WMAP is very fortunate because the reason that the photons cease to scatter from electrons isn't because the electrons become very diffuse, it's because the electrons disappear suddenly into an atom. We would not have CMB power spectra if decoupling took place this way, because then the surface of last scatter would be very thick. The reason we have a CMB power spectrum that's interesting is because on a cosmological time scale, the surface of last scatter is a pretty sharp surface.
Yeah. Okay, but so then a corollary question is, WMAP can convert their results into this power spectrum, right? So does it extend up to a region where you can hope to see this?
Oh, no, no. This is a...
No, again.
WMAP goes, you know, up to L of, say, 1,000, more or less.
Oh, that's as far as it goes.
L of 1,000 is about a megaparsec,
yeah.
10 megaparsecs. And these Earth mass halos, actually I don't remember the exact number, but it's of order fraction of a parsec. It's many orders of magnitude away. Many orders of magnitude away.
And SDSS would be many orders of magnitude off.
Yeah. Many orders of magnitude. Okay, so the first structures that undergo gravitational collapse have masses of around an Earth mass within a few orders of magnitude, and the redshift collapse is roughly a few hundred. Let's see. The velocity dispersion in these Earth mass halos . So these first objects that form will have masses something like that. They'll have, you know, Navarro-Frank white density profiles. And the typical velocity dispersion can be estimated. The velocity dispersion will be the size of the object divided by the dynamical time of the object. And the dynamical time is just Newton's constant times the densities of these objects. So the minus 1/2. The density of the objects... Oh, yeah. It's good you're here. This is the formula missing from the paper. Where's Stefano? Oh, I just left. Because I was just telling him, I was looking at this paper preparing. There's a typo that I found, and then we should have put this in the paper. I just noticed yesterday, but it hasn't gone to proof. It hasn't gone to press quite yet. So the other thing that you need to know is that when... So what happens is if I have an expanding universe that's homogeneous, but on top of that homogeneity I have a tiny region, a small spherical region that's slightly overdense. That overdensity expands with the rest of the universe. At some point, though, it becomes increasingly overdense, and then it breaks off from the expansion, it undergoes gravitational collapse, and then that halo virializes to form a galactic, that object virializes to form a galactic halo. And those gravitationally bound objects that are formed virialize to a density that's 200 times the mean density of the universe at the collapse redshift. So the collapse redshift is the mean density of the universe at the collapse redshift is the mean density of the universe today, rho matter bar times 1 plus the redshift of collapse cubed. So the density of the universe today is whatever the density of the universe is today. The collapse redshift will be 100, so this will be a factor of 10 to the 9th. It'll be about 200 times the mean density of the universe. So, for example, if you look at in the galactic halo, the local galactic halo density is about 0.3 GeV per centimeter cubed. And this turns out to be about 10 to the 4th times the mean density of the universe. And from this, what we can infer is that the collapse redshift for the Milky Way, or at least the inner parts of the Milky Way that we occupy, is roughly 10. Well, a little less than 10. No, not 10, about 10. Okay. So the velocity dispersion is going to be R over T, the size of the object divided by T. The dynamical time is Newton's constant times rho to the minus 1/2. The density of these objects is 200 times the mean density of the universe at the redshift of collapse. All of this is known. And the radius, the size of the object, is roughly the mass divided by the density to the 1/3. And so you can plug in numbers, and the thing that comes out, which is the most interesting part, is that the velocity dispersion in these galactic halos in units of the speed of light is 6 times 10 to the minus 9. And it scales with this cutoff mass divided by an Earth mass to the 1/3. So that's a fairly weak dependence. And it's ZC over 200, the collapse redshift of the 1/2, so that's also a fairly weak dependence. So the first halos, the collapse, have velocities 6 times 10 to the minus 9th, or 10 to the minus 8th, or roughly 5 orders of magnitude greater than the velocity dispersion in the galactic halo today. So if you have a 1 over V enhancement for these annihilation cross-sections, and if that 1 over V enhancement is really 1 over V, all the way down to V equals 0, then the cross-section for annihilation in these early halos is huge, compared with what it is today. So, let me erase everything except for that formula.
So, from the point of view of this is not some kind of cooling or something. It's just the statement that by falling into these gravitational wells, it didn't get sped up more than this, right? That's kind of the statement.
Right.
I mean, the ambient velocity is not bigger than this, right? I mean, there's some average density of WIMPs floating around, and then they fell into one of these things, and this is just saying that they didn't get accelerated very much.
Right, but here, okay, but there's something I
changed the
relevance. Right, there's something that I neglected to tell you, which is that at any time in the history of the universe, there's a characteristic mass scale for gravitationally bound systems. And to a first approximation, all of the mass in the universe is contained in gravitationally bound systems of that mass scale. So currently, the characteristic mass scale is around a cluster mass, or maybe a group mass, 10 to the 14th solar masses or thereabouts. So to a first approximation, most of the dark matter particles, 90% or whatever it is of the dark matter particles in the universe, are housed in gravitationally bound systems of that mass. At a redshift of 10, that number was more like 10 to the 10th solar mass. So at a redshift of 10, 90% of dark matter particles were housed in galactic halos of that size. And at a redshift of 100, when all this started, or redshift of 200, 90% of the dark matter particles were housed in galactic halos of this size. So every dark matter, so the velocity dispersion for most of the dark matter, the vast majority of the dark matter of the universe, was about 10 to the minus 9. Before that, the dark matter was smoothly distributed. But after redshift of 100, when structure formation started, then every dark matter particle is housed in a black hole.
I guess I'm asking about comparing it to there's some average thermal velocity of dark matter, right? That it had, whenever it kinetically froze out, it's got some thermal velocity. So
that
velocity was larger than the 6 times 10 to the minus 20, 6 times 10 to the minus 9, or whatever. I would be puzzled by these things got cooled.
Right, right.
But
yeah, so
that's not, that was my question.
Yeah.
That's not what's happening, right?
Yeah, so if the dark matter is, if the dark matter had some initial velocity dispersion that was bigger than this 10 to the minus 9, then you would not form these earliest halos. But that's what the kinetic decoupling calculation is, right? When we stay cold dark matter, we assume it's perfectly cold. When we do this kinetic decoupling, we can calculate the initial velocity dispersion, and that's that 10 to the minus 9. So this is the velocity dispersion in the first halos, and so you can calculate an annihilation rate for particles in these first halos. So gamma is n sigma v. So this is the rate at which neutral enos annihilate in these first halos. N is the number density of WIMPs in that galactic halo, and sigma v is our annihilation cross-section times relative velocity. So the inverse of gamma is, roughly speaking, the time that a WIMP sits around before it runs into another WIMP and annihilates.
Does this mean we're back at thermal equilibrium? Or we never left it?
We're not in thermal equilibrium. Now what happens is that these particles are housed in galactic halos, and so they have some number density. This is annihilation cross-section, so this is just the rate at which they'll annihilate. It's the same formula we use to calculate the rate for annihilation at the points of the positrons.
I'm still confused about my question. This velocity you're getting, 6 times 10 to the minus 9.
Uh-huh.
If I take 100 GeV wind,
uh-huh.
that corresponds to some incredibly low temperature, right? So
yeah.
10 to the minus 16 GeV.
Right.
So that means that just from freezing out, if I wanted them to be that cold, be much, much smaller than any temperature you're talking about here. So somehow I'm confused about, you're saying that the average velocity of a wimp inside...
Oh, how do they get from...
How do they get so cold?
How do they get from an MeV to
yeah.
to this?
Yeah, how do they get so cold?
It's just the redshift. The momentum, what's the... So they're not relative.
Oh, I'm sorry. So you're just saying they...
And they redshift more rapidly than radiation, because it's the momentum that goes
okay.
1 over A, and T is P squared over temperature, is
okay.
P squared over temperature.
Okay.
Okay, so gamma is N sigma V. We plug in the formulas we had before. This turns out to be 2 times 10 to the minus 17. Weak dependence on the cutoff mass. Minus 1/3. Our annihilation cross-section parameter, which is supposed to be of order unity if the model is going to explain what it's supposed to explain. There's a fudge factor, which we call B2.6, which depends on how the matter within the galactic halos is distributed. And that requires some astrophysical modeling. This is the most conservative value. B2.6 equals 1 is the most conservative value. And it may be as large as 50 or so. So it's just some parameter that describes how the mass is distributed within these galactic halos. There's a weak dependence. Actually, no. On the collapse redshift. It depends inversely on the mass of the WIMP in units of TeV. And the units here are seconds to the minus 1. So that's the rate at which WIMPs annihilate in these first halos if they have a cross-section sigma 26. The age of the universe at a redshift of 100 or 200 is 2 times 10 to the 14th seconds times that redshift in units of 200 to the minus 3/2. And so what this means is that a fraction f, gamma t, which is 4 times 10 to the minus 3, mass to the minus 1/3, sigma 26, b 2.6, collapse redshift to the 100 over 200 to the 1th power, m chi over TeV to the minus 1. That means that that fraction of particles annihilates in those first halos. And that's actually a big number.
What is T, sorry? What is T, little
d? T is the age of the universe at this redshift. So this is the rate, this is the age of the universe. So this is, roughly speaking, the fraction of particles that are annihilated in those first halos. And remember, the model is introduced to explain positrons in the galactic halo or photons in some radiation background scenarios. And so if the WIMP annihilates directly to photons, then one of two things can happen. So let's suppose that the photons are produced with an energy E sub I. So they're injected into the universe with an energy E sub I at a redshift of 1 or 200. And the amount of energy that's injected into these photons is this fraction of the matter density of the universe. Sorry, this fraction of the matter density of the universe. So there are two possibilities. So let's see. I'll make a little flow chart. So if the energy of the injected photon in units of, if the energy of the injected photon lies between 100 keV and 300 GeV, then the universe is transparent to these photons, and these photons show up as a diffuse background of gamma rays. And there are constraints to the diffuse gamma ray background. They show up as a diffuse gamma ray background, and the energy density in this case is the fraction of the dark matter density. So omega matter is times rho c is the dark matter density today. F is the fraction of them that annihilated to photons in the early universe. And then there is an additional factor, which is 1 plus z to the minus 1. Because the energy density in radiation redshifts relative to the matter density with the factor 1 over 1 plus z. And it shows up as a diffuse background with this energy density and an energy, photon energy, which is E sub I divided by 1 plus z. So you can plug in numbers for this, and then you can compare with the observations.
Sorry, just to make sure I'm following this. I should have asked this earlier, but your top formula there, the annihilation there, that's with this 1 over V form.
Right.
Assuming that it goes all the way down to whatever V you're going to end up.
And you want to know about the saturation.
No, I just wanted to make sure I was
okay.
Following.
I'll tell you about
that. I don't have any good agenda. I'm an idiot.
Okay.
So if you have some saturation at like V of about 10 to minus 4, 10 to minus 5, is it still a constraint?
Let's go through the entire calculation, and then I'll show you what changes if there's saturation. Because it's relatively easy to see how the results are changed after we get to the end. So I wrote a paper with Zhu Lei Chen a couple of years ago. So this statement here, gamma rays can be absorbed by various processes as they propagate through the intergalactic medium. They can scatter from electrons, they can scatter from cosmic microwave background photons, etc. It turns out, though, that if you go through all the processes and consider do the calculation carefully, if you inject a photon with an energy between 100 keV and 300 GeV at a redshift of a few hundred, it actually travels all the way to today without scattering to a first approximation. So these show up as a diffuse gamma ray background. And then what we did is we found an upper limit to the gamma ray background. So the energy density in photons is today less than 5 times 10 to the minus 16th m sub chi divided by TeV, GeV per centimeter cubed. We take this fraction, we plug in these numbers, we take that upper bound, and what we conclude is that comparing the rho gamma, which is proportional to F, which is proportional to all this stuff, which includes the sigma 26, demanding that it's less than this observational upper bound gives us an upper limit to sigma 26, which is 2 times 10 to the minus 5 B2.6, which is that fudge factor to the minus 1, weak dependence on the cutoff mass, and mass of the WIMP in units of TeV. So if we were to postulate this 1 over V enhancement to account for that boost factor of a factor of 1,000 in the Milky Way, what we would need is for sigma 26 to be less than 2 times 10 to the minus 5. And maybe down even by a factor of 50, maybe even a factor of 50 smaller, because we took a very conservative limit for this V2.6, a very weak dependence on these masses. In most WIMP models, M sub C is actually smaller than M sub M Earth. And if you have 600 GeV instead of a TeV, then it's a little bit weaker still. The other thing I should tell you, this gamma ray background, this upper limit, this is a very conservative upper limit. What we did, because we wanted to keep the paper simple, and we're lazy, is we found a plot of old data, more than a decade old. I think it was the Grand Unified Photon Spectrum paper from the late 80s by Ressel and Turner. Actually, we used something a little more recent, but people plotted gamma ray background points, so rho gamma, d rho gamma in units of d e gamma is a function of gamma ray or photon energy. And there's, you know, X-ray background, gamma ray background, higher energy gamma ray background. There are constraints from all different types of measurements. And the data actually don't even fall along a line. But what we did is we just drew a line that went above all the points to a first approximation. And the points are not upper limits to the diffused background. Those points are actually the detected background, most of which is due to astrophysical sources. In some frequency bands, we know that almost all of it is due to astrophysical sources. In other frequency bands, we can sort of assume or guess. But this is a conservative upper limit, and I'm estimating that Fermi, formerly known as GLAST, should be able to improve within their energy range by over a factor of 10 to the 4. So GLAST is not only bigger than EGRET, it also has better angular resolution, and so much of the diffuse gamma ray background, which we believe to be due to point sources but can't really say for sure now, will be resolved, and we'll actually be able to improve the upper limits to the sensitivity to the gamma ray background by a few orders of magnitude more with Fermi. So this I believe to be a very conservative upper limit to this parameter sigma 26. Now, that's what happens if the photons are produced in this energy regime. Suppose, though, that you produce photons with energy greater than 300 GeV or less than 100 keV. If you produce photons outside of that energy range, then what happens is the gamma rays get absorbed by the intergalactic medium. They ionize and heat the intergalactic gas. And we actually have very tight constraints from the cosmic microwave background. We know from the cosmic microwave background that the fraction of the matter in the universe that could have been converted into radiation that gets absorbed by the intergalactic medium is less than about 10 to the minus 9. And the detailed analysis that shows this was done in this paper with Shulei Chen, and then more recently in a paper by Zhang et al. And that analysis is actually very detailed. It's got the whole cosmic microwave background, Markov, Monte Carlo chain. Markov chain, Monte Carlo. A lot of technicality, but the result can actually be understood. So the fraction of the baryon density. Sorry, the baryon density divided by the matter density is about 1/6. And the binding energy of an atom is about 10 electron volts, which is a fraction of about 10 to the minus 8 of the rest mass energy of a particle. Yes. So the amount of energy... If I have a dark matter particle, suppose it weighs a GeV. Actually, suppose it weighs a... How do I want to say this? Every GeV of dark matter that goes to radiation can ionize 10 to the 8th atoms. And there's 1/6 of an atom for every 1/6 of an atom for every dark matter particle, for every GeV of dark matter. So we know from the cosmic microwave background that the universe was neutral at redshifts greater than 10 or so. That is a very robust result, and so we know that the amount of ionizing radiation that was injected into the intergalactic medium at early times had to be less than 10 to the minus 9th of the dark matter density. And so if the photons fall outside of this transparency band, then the limit on sigma 26 becomes even more severe. It's about 2 times 10 to the minus 7. And now there's a slightly different dependence on the energy. There's a B 2.6 to the minus 1, that same factor here. Collapse redshift divided to the minus 1. And this one depends on the mass of the wind. So the bottom line is, no matter what the injection energy of the photon is, if you have dark matter particles decaying at high redshift, then there are very stringent constraints from the CMB or from the gamma ray background. The CMB constraint is probably not going to get any stronger. It's probably about as strong as it's going to get. This constraint is going to get stronger, maybe by up to 4 orders of magnitude, depending, of course, on what the results of the experiment are.
So there is some annihilation fraction of the photons that would feed into this, which would scale all the bounds.
Right. But the models, I have to get to the positrons. I have to get to the positron still. Okay?
Right, but this was assuming that the annihilation fraction was a photon.
Well, the sigma 26 is the parameter is the cross section of 4.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
So now, we don't have in Pamela a problem with photons, we got a problem with the electrons and positrons. But the arguments are more or less the same. So if the WIMP produces electron positron pairs, then the CMB density, energy density at a redshift of 100, is 10 to the 8th times the energy density today. So the cosmic microwave background energy density is pretty large. And so these electron-positron pairs get absorbed by the cosmic microwave background through inverse Compton scattering. So if I inject an E plus E minus pairs, an E plus E minus pair into the early universe, they very quickly upscatter CMB photons, and those just turn into gamma rays. And then all the other bounds that I've discussed apply just as well. So the energy of the photon that's injected is equal to the energy of the electron divided by the electron mass squared times the energy of the CMB photon. And when you plug in the numbers, what this means is that if the electron-positron energy injection is a GeV to a TeV, or thereabouts, then this shows up as a gamma ray background. And outside this energy range, you get the CMB constraint. So it's pretty constraining. You know, we have many orders of magnitude, and the only thing left to discuss, though, is what it means for models that have a Sommerfeld enhancement that saturates. So the Sommerfeld enhancement is, in fact, a 1/V enhancement, but in the models that people have been considering in the literature, there's a saturation. The cross-section gets enhanced by 1/V up to some maximum cross-section. So, if that saturation occurs, then so if there's a saturation, then the maximum enhancement occurs at a factor 1 over V, which is roughly the wimp mass divided by the mass of the new phi particle that's exchanged. So in the various models, M sub phi takes on various types of masses between, say, a couple of MeV to a few GeV. And these bounds can be modified for this case. And it's very simple. The bounds, if there's the saturation, are simply weakened by a factor, which is the maximum value of 1 for C over V times M phi over M chi. So all we need to do to generalize these bounds to the case where the saturation is multiplied by this thing here.
Sorry, what do you mean by V in this?
Oh, yeah, sorry about that. So this V is the thing that I erased. That's the velocity dispersion in the first halos.
Okay,
this is
the velocity.
Yeah.
Velocity.
Which is 10 to the minus 9 times those other factors.
Unless the thing cuts off below 10 to the minus 9 times other factors, it doesn't change the bound. It's got to cut off. No, it's the,
It's not 10 to the minus 9. This is 10 to the minus 3. No.
Because that would be, you want the V that you use by more.
Right, and the thing is that if the V, the minimum, there's some V min, let's call that V min, that M pi over V pi, right, or M pi over pi is V min.
Right.
V min is bigger, you should weaken the bounds, right?
That's right.
You're not getting as much of an enhancement.
Right.
So if you're saying it's got to be, so if it's, as soon as V starts getting bigger than 10 to the minus 9, you're weakening the bounds.
Yeah.
So I don't think you mean what you're bringing there. You just mean
multiply or divide by this. So for example, if the wimp mass is a teeny V, then the results are, the bounds are unaltered for M phi less than 6 keV. Is that right? GeV, MeV, keV. Yes. That's right. And the bounds are weakened all the way to 1. If M sub phi is bigger than 26 GeV. So the bottom line is that this constraint does not necessarily rule out the models, but you have to be careful with the parameters, first of all, and second of all, it is a conservative limit. And so you might need to do even better than. That's GeV.
For which of the two bounds?
This is when. This is the value at which sigma 26 becomes equal to 1.
It's for the other bound. It's for your 10 to the minus 7 bound, right?
Is it? It might be. Actually, I don't remember right now. Yeah, it might be. Let's see, you're saying
takes 2 times 10 to the minus 5. Yeah, it looks more good. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. So for this bound, it would be even smaller. Huge even. Fraction of G even.
So if I completely ignore one of her V effects and I simply say I want to explain Pamela,
uh-huh.
the boost factor that's bigger than what I would expect from thermal freeze out, and I just put that number in, that's okay. If I just say that I measure what the Pamela cross section is,
uh-huh.
and I just put that number in and say there's no one for V scaling, I just put that number in. Or I just choose a saturation so that it's right on the
Oh, yeah, if there's no 1 over V scaling, then there's no problem.
With Pamela by itself. Given that Pamela sees...
Right.
Yeah.
All this, so the reason that you get these very stringent constraints is from the 1 over V
mm-hmm.
enhancement.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you have that 1 over V enhancement in the galactic halo,
yeah.
it's going to be 5 orders of magnitude larger in the first object that form.
Right. And the other question is, in the models that have M5, so... the case of a 5 being something like 26 GeV.
Right.
In that case, if you only annihilate through that 5, which a lot of these Sommerfeld enhancement models have, then M5 also appears, I think, you said in the MC?
The MC?
Because it changes the kinetic freeze-out?
I don't think it does, because, as I said, I think, that would make this number even smaller. Right, if
which
we
makes
have
it, no, which makes it a stronger bound.
Yeah, stronger bound. Yeah, yeah, stronger
bound. I'm asking whether actually when you say,
yeah.
When you put these M5s in.
Yeah, if WIMPs talk only to 5s.
Which these Sommerfeld enhancement models often have.
Well, no, not really, because in those models, as I understand it, you've got standard decoupling in the early universe. And then you have this enhancement that takes place at small velocity in the galactic halo. So chemical freeze out in those models is unaltered. It's a standard WIMP.
But then the models where the standard freeze out is not going directly to.
I make a suggestion
yeah.
that we break for coffee and continue this discussion. Are you at a place, or do you want to? Are you at a natural stopping place? Where
yeah, this is a natural stopping place. I was just going to tell you a few other things very
yeah,
briefly.
Why don't we continue this? You know, then we'll segue into a general discussion after coffee. Okay. Let's just temporarily thank Mark and